friends and my concerned fellow men and women. This is Red Eyes Radio, and the website is redeyescreations.com. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in today. We continue to alert you to the dangers of the kind of Europe that is being created against our wishes right now. Well, at least against most people's wishes. As we further spiral out of control with attacks, rapes, stabbings, shootings, and even bombs going off, you know, all the wonderful, spicy vibrancy that comes with enforced multiculturalism given to us by Merkel, Reinfeldt, and the other traitors and weaklings in European politics. You do realize that this isn't going away, right? You do realize that we have to do something about this, or it will never stop. It will stop, of course, when we are gone, pushed out from our own countries, and either quickly, or perhaps slowly, over time, murdered, targeted, and ultimately genocided. This is where it's going, whether you realize it or not. There's no doubt in my mind. And the question is, what will it take you to take a stand with us on our side? In fact, we had another stabbing just today at a Swedish school. As a 15-year-old student from Lithuania, Arminas Pikelas, that was actually standing up for the other pupils in the school because they were being harassed by this refugee, Ahmad, from Syria. He was bugging the other students, threatening the girls at the school. So, of course, due to the fact that he was challenged by Arminas, you know, his honor was tarnished and hurt. He ended up stabbing him to death after Arminas was laying down on a bench in the school, more or less half asleep. That's like being stabbed in the back. The other notable aspect to this is that his name, the suspect's name, hasn't been plastered all over the Swedish media, together with his photo, just as we saw after the Trollhättan stabbing. Remember that case? The Swedish young man who was shot to death by police? It's interesting, isn't it, that the media, the authorities, the school, everybody goes to this incredible length to help to protect these murderers that are in our countries. And you know he's going to get off too, right? You know that he's not going to be convicted. He's going to be too young. He's going to be maybe put in some kind of juvenile, you know, correction or something like that. And then, of course, he's going to get out. He's going to be further hardened under these conditions, criminalized, if you will. He's going to probably go on to rape women, probably go on to have a life of wonderful crime in Sweden, where no one says anything, no one does anything, everyone looks the other way. Yeah, this is just the beginning, folks. Well, we're going to kind of talk about some of the related issues to this, more or less, in the back end of this, with the libertarian realist that we have with us today. It's going to be on the topic of race realism, libertarianism, economy, and demographics. This was actually recorded in early December before we did the recording with Christopher Cantwell on a somewhat similar subject. But, I was not at my best when doing this recording, so we just decided to hold off on publishing it for a little bit. Now, libertarian realist did great. It was just me that was, you know, a bit under the weather and not clear-headed, if you will. But it is an important program, nonetheless, with many additional criticisms of libertarianism and also the good aspects of it. You know, this is in an effort to try to reach out to those people on this branch of the ideological tree and have them see our position on many of the issues that we discuss on this program. So let's get to it. Hope you enjoy. Libertarian realist, welcome to Red Eyes Radio. It's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, greetings from Montana. It's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners from wherever they may be in the world.
Excellent. Montana. So is it getting cold there yet?
Yeah, we got a little bit of snow on the ground.
There you go. Is that early or late, or is it about how it usually is?
Well, I am relatively new to Montana. This will be my first winter in Montana. I decided to live here on a full-time basis over the summer. And so I'm looking forward to being able to adapt to the environment.
There you go. Is there any demographic reasoning behind that choice?
Well, there is a little bit of a demographic reasoning. There's only about 1 million people in Montana. It's one of the most sparsely populated states in the Union, and it's one of the whitest states in the Union, and it's one of only two states, I believe, along with Wyoming, that does not have a formal refugee resettlement program. However, our Democrat governor and our Democrat senator have said that they are open to working with the Obama administration to import Syrians, welfare-dependent Syrians, of course, into Montana cities such as Missoula. So just as I arrive, I may be joined by some refugees.
Wonderful. Some diversity. Well, that's good. They tell us how good that is for us, right? So you should enjoy that. God, I'm being facetious, of course, here. But no, this is an important point, though. I definitely want to go into this in more detail here as we continue to talk about this. But before we kind of talk about the current situation a bit and about what's happening and with the refugee crisis in Europe and everything that's kind of driving this, if you will, behind the scenes. But tell us a bit about your channel, when you started that, and tell us a bit about the name, too, Libertarian Realist. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I started the channel a few years ago. I believe it was in 2010, after I made a trip into Europe and I visited Switzerland for the first time. And I put out a video called The Demographic Decline of Switzerland. And that got some attention and that kind of got me noticed a little bit. I picked the name Libertarian Realist because I've been what I would call a genetic libertarian all my life, in the sense that I am the type of personality that resists overreaching authority, that is open to new experiences, and that values independence over conformity. But I realized over time that that ideology in itself is not sufficient to sustain a society, or indeed to sustain liberty. So I call myself a libertarian realist because I take into account the cultural realities and the biological realities, which are the underpinnings of a truly free society.
Very good. Now, tell us a bit more about the kind of the path you went through. I mean, as we spoke a little bit about briefly before we started here, I was too kind of, I guess, consider myself a libertarian in the sense for maybe, I don't know, maybe like a year before moving on and really kind of grappling with the immigration issue in Sweden, among other things, and just seeing how bad it was there. But I've been going from more earlier in my teen years, maybe more from a left position over to, anti-authority and that kind of thing, and being later more of a developed, economically speaking, a libertarian. But now something completely different. But how what was your path like? How did you go through these different changes?
It was gradual. As I developed from just the pure adoption of the non-aggression principle, then I discovered Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism. And at first I thought it was odd because she was making all these prescriptions about aesthetics and morality. And I was like, what does this have to do with the non-aggression principle? All we need to care about is that you don't initiate force. But so right. She got me off of that at least. And then I got off of Randian objectivism because I realized that her philosophy lacked any kind of appreciation for or acknowledgement of the genetic and biological realities. It is very hostile to any kind of biological explanation for human behaviors because the objectivists regard that as determinism. But that just evidences the fact that they don't understand what heritability is. A lot of people who are libertarians and even conservatives blame all disparities between the races and other groups on culture, which at root leads them to believe that it's all a matter of choice. So they're kind of free will absolutists. But if you understand heritability, you understand that choice is just a manifestation of some biological influences and some environmental influences. And so all variations in human behaviors have some environmental and some genetic components. And so when you see patterns of variations among groups, such as blacks versus whites, in a similar environment, such as the same school, then you're going to have to acknowledge that there's a significant genetic component to these observable variations.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk some more here about both Ayn Rand and objectivism and you know, some of these kinds of earlier ideas that I think have kind of helped to spawn libertarianism as it is today. And one of the main contentions, of course, that we can discuss is this idea of, well, usually that money is smarter than people kind of approach, that, you know, the free market can take care of everything. There's no reason or worry that we have to have about race or about biology in that sense, or that we don't have to have any borders or whatnot. Is that one of the first things that you kind of started to notice and turned against, or was it something else that made you kind of look in a different direction to try to get answers to some of these questions?
I was never really a champion of open borders, at least in practice. I mean, the standard libertarian line is that open borders and a welfare state are incompatible. And so my view is that as long as we have this welfare state that's incentivizing freeloaders to come in, we should not allow freeloaders to come in, and we should not automatically grant them citizenship and amnesty and all the rest of it. But the more fundamental objection to open borders, I think, is or can be firmly grounded in the principles of liberty, because if you're going to define a particular geographic area, your own country, as a country that champions liberty, then it would be a contradiction to allow people who are hostile to liberty to come in and invade your country.
Right. Yeah. You'd think so. You wrote a good piece on this, some of the details on terms of objectivism and immigration, and you talked about Harry Binswanger. I was into his work for probably a couple of months, actually. I thought it was interesting. Really? There's some good points there, of course. It's not that. But it was interesting to see that you lifted out that he's like advocating for amnesty for you know, these illegal immigrants. But even that's not enough. They need to have an apology, right? So,
yeah, that was astonishing coming from an objectivist who's supposedly an advocate of self-interest and egoism, calling for a collective apology to illegal aliens because we did not grant them amnesty. And so this just, in my opinion, shows that objectivism, as practiced by people like Binswanger, is a self-destructive ideology. Open borders libertarianism is a self-destructive ideology. And open borders leftism, at least as practiced in the West, is also self-destructive, because the left are advocating for the importation of people who are hostile to almost everything that the left claims to advocate.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know there's a lot of different, obviously, branches, as always. This occurs in any kind of, within any ideology, if you want to call it that. There's a lot of different branches, a lot of different groups. They have different views on it. And I know plenty of you know, kind of libertarian-minded people that aren't in favor of open borders. So I'm not trying to take this as a concept to associate that with many libertarians. But can you talk a bit more about why you think it's not, how should we put it, not strong enough in terms of what we are facing now demographically with immigration? We can separate, you know, talk about Europe in one you know, section, if you will, and then focus on America in the next, if there's enough differences between them so we don't group them together. But my question is about, you know, this aspect that it's basically not powerful enough. It seems to me that the threat that we're faced with in terms of the massive amounts of people that are coming in is going to cause conditions where it's basically not going to work anymore. What can you say about that?
You're exactly right. And what I talk about is an ideology that encompasses genetics, borders, freedom, and aesthetics. Those, I say, are the four pillars of a highly successful society. Now, the typical open borders libertarian just wants to sort of absolutize the non-aggression principle and take freedom as what Ayn Rand would call a floating abstraction, just this ideal detached from the real world realities, such as those of immigration. And so in order to have a society that respects liberty, you have to have an immigration policy that selects for liberty.
Right. So would you say that libertarianism, even the idea of liberty in itself, that's a Western man's invention, right? A white man's invention?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's certainly part of our American founding tradition. It comes out of the Enlightenment, the American credo, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But Thomas Jefferson was not an open borders libertarian. He did not believe in an egalitarian conception of human differences. I mean, he was a race realist before the term existed. And he certainly was not in favor of importing people who did not have the cultural understanding to be able to live compatibly in a free society.
Yeah, I mean, do you think Muslims or Hindus or, we can talk of maybe some Asians and whatnot, do they care in the sense about the idea of liberty in the way that Western man does?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, if you look at surveys of the world's most economically freest country, every year Hong Kong comes out on top. It's made up predominantly of ethnically Chinese people. But Hong Kong exists as a legacy of British colonialism.
Right, right.
The Chinese have just sort of allowed it to maintain the British freedoms that were the foundation for Hong Kong's existence. So I guess to answer your question, I don't know if East Asians, I don't know if they would have had the sort of independent spirit, the sort of creative drive that is typified by Western achievers in order to create the sort of free and prosperous societies that the West has managed to create. But I do think that they are capable of maintaining them.
What would you say to, let's say, libertarians that are listening that, think that their approach to things is it's perfectly fine if we just apply those kinds of, rules, whatever you want to call it, those principles, things would basically work out and things would work. What would you say to them to kind of wake them up to some of the critiques that you have of this, that basically get them over a little bit more to your side, if you will, of start looking at race, start looking at biology and inherent differences within us? How would you wake them up?
Well, I would tell them that, I respect the idea of the non-aggression principle, but that is simply a negative. That's just like a starting point, how you interact in society should be put to the test of whether it infringes on another person's ability to act how they want to act. It doesn't tell you what a society should be like. It doesn't tell you how you should act. It doesn't even tell you whether pursuing things like economic growth are good. It just says don't aggress. So if that's all you have, and this would be referred to as a form of thin libertarianism, just the non-aggression principle, if that's all you have, that's really kind of nihilistic. It's not sustainable. It's not something that's going to captivate people. You need an ideology that integrates not only these abstract political principles, but the particular character and the particular values in which these principles can actually thrive.
Yeah, usually you hear, for example, Nazi Germany as brought up as the kind of the worst example imaginable that you can have of authoritarianism or tyranny or government oppression of the people and whatnot. But what I found curious is that it's usually done kind of, well, in a vacuum to a certain extent, that it's done without kind of looking for the reasons why National Socialism arose in Germany. There's other examples we could talk about, other systems as well. So it's not only that, but I'm taking one of the most extreme examples I can think of in that regard. But just this idea that if some of the methods of a government or a people ultimately arose out of self-defense, if that's true, then it would be curious if libertarians had something against it, right? Because as far as I know, they don't have anything against defending oneself if one is in a position where you're threatened, right?
Yeah, well, and there is a sense in which National Socialism in Germany and communism in Russia, which were ideologies that didn't emerge organically from the society, but were largely imposed on the populations in a totalitarian manner. And yes, I know Hitler did sort of use the democratic process to ultimately come to power, but I don't think the Nazis ever had an absolute majority support of the German people. But the point is that there's a sense in which libertarianism is also conceived of as a sort of totalitarian ideology. They just seek to impose this abstract idea and these strictures on a society, and they're sort of, in a way, Marxist because they are structuralists. They believe that changing the structures of society will cause the people of that society to change, and their human nature would simply be more better expressed once you change the structure. And so that, I think, is kind of a methodological framework that plagues a lot of libertarians.
Right, exactly. And well, would you be opposed to a strong government, or let's say a good leadership governmental, that was that truly had the best interest of the people at heart? I brought this up a couple of times in the show, but it feels to me that we're so accustomed to, you know, politicians being self-serving in that regard, and they are doing everything they can just for themselves, or the leadership is so corrupt that we are unaccustomed to this idea of what it would be like to have a good intended leader that actually looked after the interests of the people. And therefore, I think a response from many people is to think, well, the answer then must be not to have a leader at all, right? To just get rid of all that nonsense, and then finally it will be better. I knew that I thought like that for a while when I was, you know, more in that, kind of just thinking about freedom and the concept of being able to do what we want to do as human beings and being left alone, basically. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think probably the best form of government would be some form of meritocratic aristocracy, right, where it's not democracy, it's not us giving power to a leader or a set of leaders, it's the elites in society emerging to govern a society based on what Jefferson might call enlightened principles. I mean, that's kind of an idealistic view of government, but I think that's the one that's best grounded in the realities of human nature.
Right, so in that regard, you're an elitist, right?
I don't mean
that in a derogatory way at all. I'm saying that, you know, thinking about having the most able and capable people in charge of the system, that seems reasonable to me. Why wouldn't you want to have the most, the most well-equipped person being in charge of that aspect of society, right?
Right. I am definitely an unapologetic elitist, but I'm not willing to entrust a single dictator with the kind of powers to decide for himself. Even if he was a dictator who happened to agree with me on everything, it would still be extremely dangerous. I mean, what if he dies? Who's going to inherit that power? So we need to have checks on the power of government, and we need to have checks on democracy. I'm for definitely, in the meantime, restricting voting. I mean, it's ridiculous, the idea that it's easier to register to vote than it is to get a driver's license or do anything else. I mean, you've got voting is a coercive power that you're allowing people to exercise by proxy.
Right.
So it there has to be some minimal standard. You have to understand what you're voting on at minimum. I mean, literacy tests, right? Oh, those are racist. We can't have those.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very interesting how some of these positions have arose that they have. But tell us a bit more about race realism and kind of take us through that, how you woke up to some of those things and how you decided to start looking at race as a important component to trying to understand why things are the way they are.
I have to credit Jared Taylor and American Renaissance for sort of leading me down this path years ago when I was at work and I had some off time, and I'd kind of have a little guilty pleasure. I'd go on to the Amren website and I would just read the news stories. And, you know, I was kind of resistant to some of the conclusions that they wanted to draw from those stories. But I was definitely opposed to political correctness, and I was definitely very concerned about the anti-white bias in our culture and that's imposed by our government. And so gradually I discovered more into the race realists, Phil Rushton, and I would say the foundational figure is probably Charles Darwin, because his theory of evolution is kind of the whole underpinning for why groups that were isolated geographically for tens of thousands of years would naturally develop variations that extend not only to skin color, but to skeletal features, to brain size, to testosterone levels, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, tell us about some of the differences that we have then between us. I mean, what are some of the traits that make us difference, do you think, and differences on the IQ tests and all this kind of stuff? I think it's one of these areas where, due to the fact that we're not recognizing the differences and want to superimpose, you know, equality, or that we're all the same on everybody, this has done far more damage than any other thing, basically, with trying to indoctrinate people into this belief that anybody can achieve, you know, anything they want, basically, because we're all this blank slate, and we can, just as long as you give them a good education, they will achieve the same results, right? So what's tell us about what's wrong with that picture.
Well, what I find extraordinary and hard to understand, and in some ways frightening to even contemplate, is how persistent the ideology of egalitarianism has been, despite the fact that it has consistently failed to correspond with or predict realities, despite the fact that policies premised on egalitarianism have consistently failed. I mean, in the United States, you know, starting in the 1960s, we had all of these welfare programs, all of these affirmative action programs, Head Start, No Child Left Behind. And in the past few years, there have been specific programs designed to close the achievement gap, which shows up everywhere in schools between blacks, whites, and Asians. And none of these people even consider the possibility that there could be any genetic basis for these troublesome gaps. And so what scares me about that is, how do you even reason with people who persist in a delusion that is so universally disproved? How do you break them? And I don't have the answer. I mean, I try to spew out all these facts about heritability and IQ distributions, and in some ways, the facts only reinforce their egalitarianism, because they associate facts and charts and bell curves and skull measurements with scientific racism, something bad and evil. So it's this moral dogmatism. That's the only way to understand egalitarianism. It's not really a description of anything except their sense of moral righteousness about what they believe. It's a religion.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, they won't even recognize that there's differences between the male and the female, between the sexes, which is, I'm kind of stuck where you are, I guess. I really don't know how to proceed from that point if they're not willing to recognize these differences. And it's almost like beating a dead horse, I guess, to a certain extent. What do you think is going to make some of these people wake up? Because I do believe I'm right when I'm saying that more and more people are realizing how disingenuous the establishment in this regard is, with the media and education system that's trying to impose, this kind of worldview on people. And then, of course, charge them with being horrible racists, when they begin to question these things. But they're trying to impose that on everybody. But it feels like more and more people are waking up to that. They're realizing that something is amiss, something is horribly wrong in this picture that they're trying to, give us, basically. So what do you think will have people wake up to this and realize that something else is actually going on? There are differences between us, not only in sexes, but the races as well.
Yeah, I don't think it will be just the science in itself. Because if it were that, then people would have already been woken up by now, and these egalitarian myths would have been widely dispelled and not believed by anybody with any decent IQ. But, you know, Charles Murray talks about how these the discovery of the genomes and the widespread sequencing of genomes, well, that will push us over the cliff. That will make radical egalitarianism untenable. I don't think so. I don't think it will be that. I think, and this is something that is not logical from a purely scientific perspective, but from a persuasive perspective, what's going to tip the balance is if we associate race realism with something that people can emotionally attach themselves to as something that is good. Because right now, the textbooks prejudice people against any ideas of race realism by associating it with things that are bad: slavery, oppression, discrimination, racism. So we've got to clear the slate of all of those associations and create new associations and talk about things like demographic ascent, an ascending society. Talk about all of the things that we could do and could have done as far as reducing crime rates and raising the IQ of a society. All of the billions of dollars that have been spent on various welfare programs, if they just went into incentivizing intelligent people to have more children, and if we just changed our immigration policy to select for people who were culturally compatible and had high IQs, we could solve so many social problems that have proven intractable by the left's policies.
Well, exactly. It's a good point. I want to talk more about demographics a bit later here, but do you think that it's also the pressure of the blatantly anti-white media that's kind of pushing people over the edge too? It's becoming a little bit too much, you know, when you ask kids to wear, white wristbands to get them to identify as white and therefore feeling bad about who they are, right? Some people are. I think there was a case for me too, to be honest. It was certain comments made by politicians in Sweden and some others that pointed out that somehow I was supposed to feel guilty because of the group or, you know, the race, if you will, that I belong to, and that there was something wrong with us Swedish people. We had to change. And it was something that like arrived at my doorstep, and I realized that, oh, what's this? Something's going on here. They're actively trying to work against us. They don't like us. They're trying to, as you know, replace us in our own countries. But basically, in my view, they're pushing a little bit too hard. What do you think?
I think you're right. And there is a growing backlash among white people. In the United States now, support for affirmative action among whites is at record lows. Whites are increasingly leaving the Democrat Party because it's so explicitly anti-white. And, you talked about these white privilege indoctrination sessions and these absurd, politically correct horror stories that come out all the time. And I'm also encouraged by the fact that within the right and within libertarianism, there are more people sort of leaving, like the Alex Jones conspiracy stuff. He's now dedicated mostly to fighting political correctness. And,
right.
You know, when I look at videos put out by Reason Magazine or Cato Institute, which are sort of left libertarian groups, whenever they advocate open borders, they get a huge backlash among subscriber base now.
I've seen that.
So, there are encouraging signs in that regard.
Yeah, the whole NRO debacle, right? Same thing there, National Review Online. And, It's very, very interesting. It's like this, it's a new kind of edgier crowd that's coming from underneath, truly grassroots in that regard, which is, you know, turning against these little bit of more established and bigger institutions. I'm encouraged by that.
Yeah. And the Republican Party, has been really struggling to the establishment because the anti-establishment forces are now bigger than the establishment forces within the Republican Party. They tried to put up this new speaker, Kevin McCarthy, this establishment guy for Speaker of the House, and he was rejected Unfortunately, he was replaced by Paul Ryan, who's also an establishment guy, but at least the establishment didn't get who they initially wanted. And now the establishment is trying everything they can do to get rid of Trump, and none of it's working.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about Trump a little bit while we're on the topic. I wanted to ask you about this anyway. Are you encouraged about where he's taking this? Do you think that he actually will be able to solve some stuff if he actually managed to get into office? Or is it a fun show and a fun ride right now? What's your take?
You know, I've gone back and forth on this. Initially, I thought his candidacy was kind of clownish and pointless, because if you just look at a checklist of his views on issue after issue, he's really within sort of the establishment framework on everything, on Social Security, on Medicare, on military spending, although he did oppose the Iraq War, to his credit. But I think the service that he is doing to us is that he's sort of clearing the deck. And even if a lot of his protests of political correctness are kind of petty, he's still delegitimizing political correctness. And he's still sort of showing that you can be totally unapologetic and you don't have to cuck yourself to your opponents or to the establishment.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you think he'll be able to turn things around for the Republican Party, the direction that they've been going with all this cuckoldry, basically, because it's been pretty bad for a long time there. And hopefully this, at least, at the very least, maybe be able to push them in a direction where they realize they have to be more honest and straight shooting than they have been prior. It's so contrived, some of these debates and the answers to give. And what I appreciate with Trump anyway, although I don't think he's going to, you know, save America or anything like that, but I appreciate his candor and the fact that he, just as you say, he's breaking through some of this levels of political correctness, which is kind of forcing other candidates to, I think, start thinking about that, right? Because he's so popular.
Yeah, I think so. And even if he doesn't win the nomination or the presidency, the good that could come out of his campaign is that he opens doors for other people, and hopefully people who are more ideologically grounded, because Trump isn't really an ideological person. He's a pragmatist. He's gotten along. I mean, that's kind of been his approach to life and his approach to business, to just kind of manipulate the system, try to get along with people, and use the rules to your advantage. I mean, the one issue that has been his strength, obviously, has been that of fighting illegal immigration. But we also need to move on the debate over legal versus illegal immigration and take a look at the quality of the immigrants that we get. And obviously, Trump supporters implicitly do get that. But we need more explicit talk about an immigration policy that selects for quality people who are compatible with our culture and our demographic heritage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, exactly. It's true. So many things have changed in this regard. I forget the number, but what is it? It's like a million people that legally are coming into the U.S. every year, I believe. Something like that. Do you have the numbers on that?
I don't know. Supposedly the flows from Mexico have been abating, but we don't even know how many people are here illegally. Some people say it's 10 million, 5 million, 13 million, 20 million. We don't even know, but we have all of these programs that incentivize people to come here illegally. So before we build a wall, before we even know whether a wall is necessary, we need to get rid of all of these welfare programs, all of these promises of citizenship, in-state tuition, and refugee resettlement programs, and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most immigration is from China right now into America, and of course they're heavily involved in what's called birth tourism, which is basically right. What the Mexicans are doing, right? You just cross the line, you plop out your child, and then they're immediate citizens. It's remarkable. They found this, you know, this way in. Well, it's not really a huge loophole in the system or whatever, but it's this is what they do, right?
Yeah, they're anchor babies, and the legal authorization for them comes from the 14th Amendment, supposedly from the interpretations of the 14th Amendment that are put out. So, and Ron Paul used to be good on this, but Rand Paul has been kind of wishy-washy, so his candidacy is kind of completely floundered.
Yeah, Ron, nothing came of it. I'm pretty pretty intrigued by that. I thought his son would have some more oomph in him and some more balls, I guess, but I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I was very disappointed, and I thought that his strategy, his broad strategy of trying to be more appealing to conventional Republicans, in theory, that should have just he should have been able to build on the base that Ron Paul had and add to it. But instead, he's alienated most of Ron Paul's supporters because he's perceived as insincere and a sellout on a lot of issues. And he made some truly ridiculous comments about Ferguson when the blacks in Ferguson started rioting. You know, yep. Rand Paul came in and said, oh, well, we need to listen to their concerns, and we need to realize that the Ferguson police force was not very diverse, and we need to encourage them to vote. We need to. Right. That's one of his pet issues, is getting criminals voting rights.
Yeah, so right.
He doesn't have any kind of coherent message, and it's obviously not working with the Republican Party, which is a good sign.
Yeah, it's funny. They're trying to peddle to people that, you know, kind of hate them anyway by default. They probably sincerely believe that they're Nazis in the Republican Party or something like that, and they'll never like them whatever they do. I guess that is the essence to a certain extent of being a conservative, right? You try your hardest not to be called a racist, and then you're going to be called a racist anyway, right?
Right. Yeah. You have to turn every controversy about race into, well, what's good for minorities? How do we get more of the black vote? And from a strategic standpoint, this is completely a waste of time, because blacks are going to vote 90%, 90 to 95% Democrat, no matter what. If it's Obama, they'll vote 95% Democrat. So you got a tiny percentage of 13% of the population that you could possibly get to vote Republican, and Republicans spend all their time trying to pander to these minority groups that will never pay off for them. So they're doing the work of the left, and so in that way, they really are truly being cuckolds.
Exactly. Now, tell us more about the ongoing, what do you think is at the root of the ongoing population replacement? We have a program from around the year 2000, the United Nations released a report on this in terms of the fact that the population has to be replaced in many of these Western countries. They claim in that particular report that it's about the demographic decline, and I guess we could weave that into the discussion now as well on the birth rates and why those are dropping or whatnot. But the refugee explanation is something completely different, right? We're getting different explanations all the time, that sometimes it's for they need to have a better, economic situation. That's why some of these people come here. No, they're fleeing from war. No, they're here to replace us because we're not having any babies. This seems to change over the years and just kind of become whatever it needs to become to fulfill the ultimate agenda, which at the end of it is population replacement, right?
Yes, there are shifting rationales for why we should have open immigration for various different types of populations. But I think at the root of how white people in Western countries are being exploited is that their empathy buttons are being pushed and manipulated. And so the people who tried out these ideologies that say that you have to open your heart to refugees because they need more help than you do, they are engaging in weaponized empathy. They're using empathy as a weapon against people, to either turn against themselves or their fellow citizens. And another term for it is pathological altruism, concern for others taken to such an extreme that it becomes self-destructive. And, of course, Sweden is the archetypal example of this. They've probably gone more extreme than any other country in terms of the proportion of refugees that they take. What are they taking, like 200,000 this year?
Yeah, but who knows, to be honest, because I don't know anybody who's counting those 14,000 now that allegedly just went under the radar. They just disappeared. They have been talking about closing the bridge from Denmark into Sweden, the Öresunds bridge. I don't know how much what that actually means and how much that actually means that they actually will do in the physical world, or if this is just, more talk and rhetoric. But we basically, we don't know how many is coming in. There's even an airline that opened up now. Refugee Air or something they call it. It's in the beginning stages, but it was two, I think Middle Easterners that grew up in Sweden that started this airline that's basically people can donate money to fly people into Sweden. So, you know, who knows how many they're going to get in.
Yeah. They're finding cruise ships, whatever they can do just to house refugees.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah. You know, in a sense, it's the, kind of the opposite morality of what they claim to be expressing. It's really an extreme form of self-indulgence and misplaced arrogance to think that if you're in Sweden, this on the world scale, this tiny country, that you're so important and you're so powerful that you can make a difference in the way things are working in Somalia and Afghanistan and Syria and any of these other hellholes around the world where there are, I mean, literally over a billion people who could be said to be in desperate conditions, fleeing war or persecution or something else that would make them eligible for refugee status. The only thing that you could possibly accomplish if you're Sweden is to destroy yourself while you're making virtually no impact on how these life is like in all these other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Of all the, you know, we're supposed to be the best ones of all the countries that are helpful. We're going to be a moral superpower. As the former prime minister said, we're going to take in as many as we have to prove how good we are, basically. But, you know, we have that as one part of the equation that we're, you know, our kind-heartedness is obviously being, you know, exploited here. Do you think there's another half to that equation of someone who's also, you know, taking advantage of that and for their purposes and reasons, trying to fulfill the goal of having us not only become a minority in our own country, but what it looks like eventually even vanish and disappear altogether?
I do think that there is some really nefarious goals behind this population replacement programs. It's not just sympathy for the refugees. And of course you have in Sweden, Barbara Lerner Specter.
Right.
And, Nicolas Sarkozy has talked about the moral necessity of race mixing. And you have Labour Party officials in Britain talking about importing third world populations to punish the right to punish conservatives. And they're really also in Germany, of course, they're playing on this guilt over the Holocaust. And they do it in the United States, too. They say that because we didn't accept as many Jewish refugees as we could have during World War II, so never again, right?
Right.
We can't make that mistake again. So now we have to import all of these Muslims from all over the world because we didn't do our duty during the Holocaust. So this guilt, again, is being exploited throughout the West in a way that doesn't quite work in places like Japan. I mean, there are globalist organizations like Amnesty International and the United Nations that kind of pester Japan and try to get them to take in more refugees. But they know that they can't do it by inculcating an artificial sense of collective guilt among the Japanese and trying to exploit that. They have to just do the standard, well, these people need help. But in the West, it's more of a social justice crusade. It's as much about punishing the West, collectively punishing the West, as it is about supposedly helping the refugees.
Right, exactly, which means that this is something very, very, very negative that is happening. And it's an admission then that this is not going to lead to something good, which is interesting because then, you know, as you said before, then it kind of proves that this is being weaponized, really, the movement of these large populations and the incursion, the invasion, really, of so many people into very, very small European countries. That is utterly going to destroy them culturally, racially, on so many different levels. And I don't know if you do hear any talk about this, but I hear nothing about, okay, when things have improved in Syria or, you know, wherever they come from, we know that there's tons of other countries too. It's not just Syria, obviously. It's North Africa, Afghanistan, some other Asian countries. It's all over the place. And we don't hear them talking about these people returning. You know, there's nothing like that going on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in theory some of them could return or should return, but we know that as long as they're being bribed and getting comfortable on welfare benefits, that's not likely to happen.
But that's not going to work, though, obviously, right, in the long run. Unfortunately, it seems that we're heading into kind of a collapse of the somewhat successful welfare system that some of the Western and Northern European countries have managed to create and build up. And I think that that's going to lead to some kind of, you know, collapse in some regard of the infrastructure or of the economy. What do you think? And I mean, it's going to be probably turning into chaos at that stage. And maybe you could be right there that maybe at that stage, people will actually voluntarily return because they just realize there's no more handouts to get in some of these countries. What do you think?
It may well come to that in Sweden. That may ultimately be the way that this unsustainable refugee resettlement effort ends, is that it just can no longer mathematically be sustained. And I think even Sweden's leaders are starting to realize that they can't, even no matter how much they want to, they can't continue to import 200,000 refugees every year. I think Stefan Löfven, is that your prime minister's?
Yeah, Löfven, yes.
Löfven. Yeah. He's sort of acknowledged that they're going to have to scale back a little bit, right, on the refugee resettlement. Not because they don't want to, but because economic realities dictate that the whole system's going to collapse if they don't. But I would like to be able to win the argument on moral grounds that there should be the only moral basis of a country's immigration policy is to protect the citizens of that country and to reflect an immigrant inflow that is compatible and that even really, not ironically, enriches the population. Because I'm for immigration from countries where people are very intelligent, very attractive, very skilled. That would definitely enrich my country.
Right. Yeah. But it's something completely different that's going on. We'll talk more about this. Of course, I want to get deeper into the migrant wave that has been happening this past summer here into Europe and get closer into some of the demographics things as well and get your take on that and what we can do to improve those and change those. There's so many other aspects here. But before we take a break, give us the details about your website where people can go to see more of your work. If there's something else you have out there that you'd like to mention or maybe how people can follow you if you're on some of the social networks out there.
You can find my videos on YouTube, Libertarian Realist. I have a blog at libertarianrealist.blogspot.com. I'm also on Twitter at GetRealist, but my main online presence is on my YouTube channel, and I have hundreds of videos there now, and so I urge you to subscribe to that.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up to that, of course. You folks can check it out. There's some great videos there, so do take a look. But we'll take a short break here, and then we'll return with more in the second hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for, for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Take a look at the low man, meaning of the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling shallow. Is there life on Mars? Minnie Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Blue Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clowns. But the film is a sad thing more, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be written again, as I ask you to vote for some sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the law man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know. And the best-selling show is still alive on
Tune in to the second hour of our interview with Libertarian Realist on issues related to demographics, economy, endless population growth, and immigration. It's a great discussion, and we go through further aspects related to many of the topics that he covers. We talk further about discrimination, the Black Lives Matter debacle, and also what the future will be like if we continue to peddle to spending all our resources and time and efforts on conflict resolution among competing ethnic groups within the West, in addition to holding down our own and never taking our own side. We'll surely make those scientific breakthroughs and eventually go to Mars. I'm sure we will. We go into some numbers related to fertility rates in Switzerland, Japan, and a few other countries as well. If you want to hear more, go to redicemembers.com and sign up and tune in. You can stream or download. Check out our FAQ, for the help section on how you can download every show that we have on the website if you so want to. It's really easy with a podcast app if you're on a mobile device. Just subscribe to the members RSS feeds. If you're on a PC or Mac, something like iTunes will make it really easy as well. Just subscribe to our RSS feeds. We have feeds broken up by year, all the way back to 2006. We're coming up on 10 years here soon, over 1,000 radio shows. In addition, we have Radio 314, all those shows with Lana. We also have videos, films, inside episodes, and much more. It's only €6 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years, and it gets cheaper the longer one-time payment you go for. But the three-month recurring subscription is really the most popular option for many of our members. That way you don't have to sign up again and again, and you get all the latest shows come directly to you, of course, when you subscribe to our RSS feeds as well. Upcoming guests, we have Lars Vilks, Dan Park, and Henrik Rundqvist on the forbidden art that they've been involved in Sweden, and of course some of the consequences by going down this route. We have Brian Ens Patrick on the phenomena of zombies. We also have Marcus Folin, Justin Garcia, and Paul Wagoner on manhood and physique. Bill Still on how UPS is shipping in refugees into America on their cargo planes. Really bizarre story. Well, I guess it makes sense considering what the companies are doing these days. We also have Daniel Carlson, a Danish nationalist within politics, and also Christopher Hell on his book The Dark Heart of the West, and many other related topics. We've tried to get Christopher on for some time now, so it'll be good to finally get him on the show. So some good shows coming up, and of course we have new videos in the pipeline too. And also some exciting developments and updates. So stay tuned to Red Ice for much more. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you so much for listening, and do stay with us.